This is episode 431, dated Friday, September 26th, 2025.
You are listening to the In Perspective weekly podcast with Bob Branco and Peter O'Toole.
Hi, everyone, and welcome once again to In Perspective. My name is Bob Branco. Good to be here today. This is episode 431. Dated Friday, September 26th, 2025. Before we continue, allow me to introduce, as usual, our good friend, colleague, and co-host, Peter O'Toole. Peter, how you doing today?
Well, I just came home from a medical procedure, and I might be a bit loopy because of the drugs they gave me. So if I am, please forgive me. The weather here is nice today, nice tomorrow, and then it's supposed to rain all next week. So we're getting close to the rainy season in Oregon where it rains pretty steadily from October through April. So the time is getting close for our rainy season to start.
Well, summer has returned temporarily here in southern New England. The temperatures were 80 or so today, a little humid. The sun was out for half the day after 2 days of a driving rain, and it should be nice for the weekend. Allow me to thank those people who make it possible for In Perspective to be made available. We start out with Raymond Gay, our producer and editor. Thank you for what you do. Thank you also to the media sources. Thank you for airing us. We appreciate that. And of course, Jacqueline Sylvia from JS Web Solutions. Thank you for archiving our shows on my website. All people have to do to find them is to go to www.brancoevents.com. Arrow down until you get to In Perspective Podcast. Click on that, and you will see most, if not all, of our archive programs from latest to earliest.
Merci, Jackie.
Let me give a few shout-outs. Let me say hi to Steve, who's our facilitator for today's program, along with Brad, who is our streamer. Thank you very much for helping us out today. And because we are being streamed live, let me give out my email address. It is BobBranco93@gmail.com. That's BobBranco93@gmail.com for those of you who would like to write to us with your thoughts about our podcast. There are three listeners I would like to acknowledge today: Linda Lambert, Rick Troiano, and Deborah Joyce. Thank you so much for sending me your thoughts on our show. We appreciate that very much. We're very pleased today to have with us Linda Wright. She's the author of a book entitled My Turn, When Caregiving Roles Reverse. Linda, welcome to our program. We appreciate you.
Thank you, Bob. It's great to be here.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and about your background.
Okay. I am a retired librarian. Some librarians never really change. I think that my brain still thinks like a librarian. But I also tell people that it wasn't my first choice. It wasn't the thing I ever thought I would end up doing, that I was actually recruited to be a librarian. I was recruited in the Springfield, Massachusetts Public Library. And I was there because I was taking one of our neighbors, a little girl, and I was in college at the time and thought I was going to be a teacher, but I would take the little girl to the library when I was home for breaks, and the librarian who was in the children's room was so friendly and so good to both myself and to the child I was bringing in, that I became very fond of her. Her name was Wanda, and she told us her first name. She didn't expect us to even pronounce her last name. And the little girl had been born premature, lost her vision in the oxygen treatment that she was required to have. And she spent most of her time when she was not at Perkins School for the Blind. She spent most of her time with my mother because her mother no longer lived at home. And so that little child was in need of a lot of love and attention. And Wanda, the librarian, said to me when I got there, and it was probably the mid break of my senior year of college. And she said, "What are you going to do when you graduate?" And I said, "Well, I'm really not sure at this point." She said, "Go upstairs and apply to be a librarian." And I said, I don't know about that. You know, I don't know if I want to be a librarian. She said, "Do it anyway." I will watch
and
the
you
job.
And you succeeded, obviously.
I did. And so the second part of my senior year, I did student teaching. And what I learned was that I didn't really like being in a classroom. I didn't really like making kids sit in little rows at that point in the history of education. Kids were very structured and so were classrooms. And I really didn't enjoy myself at all. So when I did graduate and I went back to live with my parents in Springfield, I waited a little while to see if any of the applications came in from the school. And the first call I got was from the city library. And they said, "We have an opening for a children's librarian. Do you want it?" And I said, "Yes." I knew nothing about being a librarian. And so I showed up. They did a wonderful training there. It's a nice city library. It probably is still a nice city library at this point. And they trained me, and then I ended up working in a small branch library and loved it. So that's the story of what I did for the rest of my life. I was not only a children's librarian, but then I went on and was a consultant for libraries in institutions in Massachusetts. I worked for the Massachusetts, what was essentially the state library, but in Massachusetts, they don't call it a state library. They called it the Board of Library Commissioners. And so I visited all of the libraries in all of the state institutions and learned a tremendous amount about how you could do libraries differently, whether you were in a county jail or whether you were in a public health hospital, or there were just at that point in time, of course, this was the 1980s and there were a lot of state institutions and many of them had outstanding libraries just for the people who were residents of that particular institution.
I'm assuming you visited the Perkins Braille and Talking Book Library in Watertown.
I did. and I also, I mean, I don't even remember the names of some of the institutions, but I visited every single one of them. And luckily, Massachusetts is a relatively small state, not like where I live now, which is very large. But it was a real education. And I loved it. And then after that, I went back to public libraries and became the director of two public libraries. The first one was in Bridgewater, Massachusetts, and the second one was in Milford, Massachusetts. So that's where I started. And when I retired very early, because the other part of my story is that I was born with a very rare medical condition. And I had something that was very similar to hemophilia, which meant I had a bleeding disorder. And I had adapted to it pretty well. And was able to find a job, which I was very grateful for, that I could do physically, that was not dangerous for me to do. And, so when I retired, I actually had to retire. I was only in my 50s when I retired because I had a cerebral hemorrhage. And with my bleeding disorder, that was pretty scary and left me with some damage. And the damage includes that I could no longer read print. And so obviously I couldn't work as a librarian. It took me quite a few months to recover from that stroke. But luckily I recovered almost 100%, but I still to this day cannot make sense out of the printed word when it's flat in front of me. So people don't understand that. They are very baffled. They keep saying to me, well, we could give you large print. And I keep saying, no, I can't read print. That doesn't matter if it's large or small. But I am thrilled that there is so much available in audio at these days. And I now, are also pretty excited about what I can get from Bard, what I can get from other sources. It's just amazing. So those libraries I really want to shout out to. If it were not for them, I wouldn't be able to read anything. So, I think that the availability of materials in not a printed form are absolutely one of the best parts of this particular lifetime that I've had. So,
Linda, I'm curious. I mean, you obviously written a book, which we'll talk about in a second.
I did.
But how did you like edit the book? How did you?
I edited the book by having it, because things that are done on a computer can be read back to you.
Yeah.
And so I would write a paragraph, get it to read back to me, figure out what I had made typos on, figure out what I wanted to change in terms of format. It took me, I tell people it took me 10 years to write that book. But it wasn't all 10 years of writing the book. I started out small. I always liked writing. And so I used to, you know, even as a child, I had several pen pals. I wrote letters all the time. And so I started out writing blogs when blogs became the thing to do, which again was quite a while ago. It was like 20 years ago. And so I started writing to a blog, and the first blog I wrote to was just kind of a general, but you know, it would be only maybe 500 words of the thoughts in my head and you know, what I was doing at the time, or some of it was memories. And then because I had a lot of experience in my life with the bleeding disorder that was my bleeding disorder, but I had also been very active in the bleeding disorder community, the National Hemophilia Foundation. I was on the board of that. I was president of the New England Hemophilia Association. And so I started blogging to a second blog that was all about having bleeding disorders. And there I met internationally so many wonderful people and ended up coaching some young people to do their own writing. So anyway, I started out small. I started out writing to blogs 20 years ago. And then, you know, over time I realized, oh my goodness, I have enough here to put together and make a book. But then of course it took some editing and some rearranging and some putting things together. And I took a lot of courses, that any course that I could find on writing, and had a lot, I had wonderful critique group that I belonged to. I highly recommend people to be in critique groups. And then I was able to eventually get the book put together. But that was, it actually got published in 2017. So it's not a brand new book. But what is new is that one of my original goals was to make this an audible book. And when I looked into what it took, I wasn't in a financial position to afford to pay a professional reader to read my book. At that point, I hadn't even thought about qualifying for Bard, and it did not occur to me that they could read it for me. I do recommend that, and I know there's people who are here today who have gone that route. But when I discovered that you could get AI to read, to narrate a book, and it would sound as if it was a human voice, and you could pick the voice of the person from a list of different voices, And the cost of that was so much less than hiring a professional artist or actor or person who could read a book. And I had had a friend who did that, who hired someone to do it for them. And they, of course, take a cut of the proceeds on if the book is sold. And they also took a lot of time for my friend to listen back to what they had read and make corrections on pronunciation and the inflection of the voice. You know, was it really what the author wanted it to sound like? And with AI, I could do that all using my computer. I could listen to what the AI reader did, make corrections, zip, 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 and create a book that now has the ability to be published anywhere I want because it is self-published, which means I have control of that book. And I can, and I have given the audio version to Bookshare. It's now on Bookshare, and it will, I believe, next month be available on Bard. Because once it was read, they said, oh, this is easy. We can get this up.
So I would imagine there are a bunch of ethical issues involved with your decision. and I'm just curious about how you sort of thought through those. You know, I would imagine, for example, that if more people do what you did, a lot of folks are going to lose their jobs or lose part of their work. How do you sort of square that with, you know, sort of the decision you made that obviously was a very successful decision? You were able to make it work really well.
Well, you're right. I took a lot of heat. People immediately said to me, how can you do this? So, you know, my friend is a professional and they read books. And I said, I can't afford your friend. I mean, it's this or nothing for me. And my priority was to make this in an audio format. But I do understand. I also understand that AI is going to do that anyway. Whether I use AI or not, AI is in fact, and people are going to have to adapt and change. That's what happened when radio came on board, when television came on board, now when the internet has come on. Every time something like that happens, the existing technology has to adapt and change.
Here's the difference, though. When radio and television and everything else came on board before AI, I don't think people were losing their jobs as much, if at all.
Oh, they did. I've looked into it.
They
most certainly did. And in fact, if they didn't, I mean, there were a lot of, for example, silent movies. A lot of the actors and actresses lost their jobs because they did not have the look that the producers wanted to be on screen. They had a good voice or they could do radio, but they did not have the appearance that would go into a movie. And there were people who lost their jobs in each one of those places. We've just forgotten. It's been too long. But when I looked into the research on it, in fact, there was turnover. There were, you know, and the people who could transition, the people who were able to do both and could then go into the newer technology.
What I'm really curious about, because you mentioned radio and TV, and over time there are regulations over these things that, you know, maybe leveled the playing field a little bit or made it, you know, more fair to folks. And I'm really curious to see how AI is treated, you know, how they regulate AI, if at all.
So, yes. And again, you know, the heat I took was, you know, you shouldn't do this because the thing is, it's going to happen anyway. And my boycotting it is not going to make a difference. This is coming.
I don't want to get too deeply down this rabbit hole because I want to talk about your book.
Okay.
I guess what I would say is, the longer it takes for people to use AI, the more chance there is for regulators to make sense of how you're going to make, you know, regulate this stuff.
Right. And the regulators, but, you know, the people don't really understand the consequences.
Yeah.
I can certainly lead you to, some sources that are, that I'm watching and paying attention to about both the dangers and the benefits of AI.
It's a complicated topic. That's for another time.
That's your topic. And I'm,
that's right. For another time. So yeah. I want to focus on the book and let's start with give folks a summary of what the book's about. What's the Cliff Notes version?
Okay.
Why do people want
to
read this?
I wanted to do two things. I wanted to talk about what it was like for me as a child to have a rare disorder. And I wanted to talk about some of the discrimination against, people, especially children, and, but some adults as well, to people who have any kind of disability. And then I wanted to also describe in the book taking care of my parents, because they took care of me when I was a child. They did a beautiful job of protecting me and still giving me a lot of freedom and a lot of opportunity that was appropriate for me. I wanted to do the same for them, and that's what the book covers, when they became elderly and unable to fully care for themselves. And so I began doing that when they were 85 years old. My mother had severe osteoporosis. She had a lot of spinal fractures. She also had Parkinson's disease. My father had a lot of hearing loss. And between the two of them, they were having a lot of difficulty coping. So the book covers, it goes back and forth. I weave it back and forth to my personal experience, mostly at a young age, and then their experience as elders. And the comparison of the two is what the book is really about. And it's also about how difficult it was for a person like myself, who was still having medical issues and medical challenges. Like, after I moved them in is when I had my stroke. And so when you're a caregiver, you are under a lot of stress and you have to give up a lot of things, and it takes a lot out of you. And the book covers that as well.
So there are a number of themes that I noticed while reading the book, and I'd just be curious to for you to talk freely about in any way you want to about these themes. Let's start with the medical system. You know, how does the medical system treat you? Good, bad, the parents? Just what do you, and what is your sense of the medical system these days?
Well, it certainly is changing. It's like everything else, isn't it? When I was young, I wasn't diagnosed until I was 2 years old. This is something I was born with, but nobody really, my mother knew something was very wrong, but the doctor didn't catch it until I was 2 years old and sent me to a specialist. And luckily I went to a specialist who could diagnose it, because at that time it was so rare. It had not been diagnosed often. I was just lucky that they were able to do that. I have had both good and bad. Again, it's a both and. I have had doctors who have quite literally saved my life, made me able to do things that I wouldn't otherwise have been able to do. And I have had doctors who were so negative and so off track that it was scary, really scary. And I've learned through my years that this is my body, this is my responsibility, and I know better than most doctors who see me, especially doctors who are seeing me for the first time. And so I tend to do something that certainly my mother would never do. I speak up. I say when I don't agree. I say when it doesn't seem like it makes sense. Right now, for example, I'm doing physical therapy, a physical therapy routine. And when the physical therapist says, do this exercise, and I say, but my ankles won't do that. My ankles are frozen now. I can't do that exercise. I will do any other exercise you give me, but I can't do that one. And that's the kind of thing that a lot of people are either intimidated by medical professionals or especially doctors, to really speak up and say, no, I can't do that. That's, it's not possible.
And you learned to do this pretty young. As I remember that you went, yes. I think if I remember this, the first time to, alone, to Boston when you were like 16 years old or something, if I remember the story correctly. Yes. And you did it all on your own, which I thought was really quite remarkable.
And that's the kind of thing that my parents gave me the freedom to do. My mother was a firm believer in anything that's safe for you to do, you should do. And I was doing things that my peers were not doing. I was in the city and we had a city bus route. And even when I think I was only in the sixth grade, so I was maybe 12 years old, and my mother would say, you know, you can go downtown and do your own shopping. And when I started to realize that none of the other kids who were my age were that independent and had the ability to do things on their own. And, you know, my mother said I was not allowed to ride a bike because the doctor said that if I fell, the injuries would be serious and it would be very difficult to treat. So it was better for me not to ride a bike. Every other kid in the neighborhood was riding their bikes and I was so jealous. And my mother said, the day you turn 16, you can get a driver's license. Hang in there. And so I was the first kid in the block to go get a driver's license.
Your parents sounded like remarkable people, both parents, yes. Your mom and your dad in different ways.
Yeah.
And it makes perfect good sense why you wanted to, reverse roles, as you say in your book.
Right.
Talk a little about, the experiences you had, as a disabled person looking after your parents in various living centers. They weren't wildly positive, as I remember.
They were not wildly positive. And they were, and I really do encourage, I'm sure they're, you are much better off if you can go into those facilities and be there in person as often as possible to see things firsthand, to be able to question things and to make sure that people are being treated the way they should be treated. You do the best you can. I mean, if you're in a position where I could no longer lift either my mother or get her into a position, I didn't have the physical strength. So when she fell and broke her hip, she really needed not only to go to the hospital, but after that, she needed to be in a nursing home. And it was very, very difficult. It was not the kind of care I would have given her in person. But again, I wasn't physically able to do that. And very few people are.
Can we talk about your brush with education? You mentioned it a little before. Yeah. I found that story absolutely fascinating. You're a senior in college.
Yes.
You are student teaching. And yes. You kind of, as I remember, kind of liked it. But then a couple of things went haywire. Talk about that.
Yeah. Well, I did like it, but I had a couple of things happened in that scene. One was, and quite frankly, I don't remember whether I told all of these stories in the book or not. At this point, it's been long enough. I can't remember. But the first thing that happened was one young kid ran up to me and whacked me so hard on my shoulder that I had an enormous bruise on that shoulder. And this student, I was student teaching, and of course nobody understood, and I was marked down for when I took the time off to go ice the arm. But the second thing that happened was when I did my second round, the supervisor of the student teaching came in and he was evaluating us at the end of the term, and he said he was going to give me a C for what I had done. And at that point I was in a sixth grade class. I was teaching math and I had a student who liked very much. She was engaged in the class. She asked good questions. She was intelligent. But she didn't like to sit in her desk. She would sit on the heater. There was, you know, a heater on the side of the wall, and she would sit on top of that and ask her questions. And he had come in one day to observe me teaching, and he said to me, well, I'm marking you down because you didn't make her get in her desk. You didn't make her sit down in the desk. And I was so flabbergasted that he would care more about what she, where she was sitting than what she was learning. That was one of the points at which I said, I'm not right for this job.
This is the most amazing thing. He said, I'm going to give you a C. And yeah. finish that story. I don't want to tell it.
Okay. He said, I'm going to give you a C. And I said, that's fine. Okay with me. If that's how you're making your decision, my thought was, if that's how you're making the decision, then yeah, give me a C. Cause if I had it to do over again, I would not make her sit in that chair. So I said, yes. And he said, well, everybody else is arguing with me. If I tell them that I'm giving them a C, they argue, you'll never find a job as a teacher. I don't really care. I thought, I do not care if I'm not a teacher. And he said, but everybody else is arguing. So because you're not arguing, I'm going to move it up to a B. And I thought, I am so out of here. I mean, my reaction was, that's it. I'm done with teaching. You know, if what you want is for me to argue for a better grade instead of knowing where to evaluate my teaching skills and sticking to that, yeah. I was amazed. But my history with schools is vast. My elementary school teacher did not want to enroll me in kindergarten. My mother had to fight and get a doctor's certificate. And of course, that was at the point at which legally they could have prevented me from going to a public school. There was no law that allowed people with a disability into a public school. So because my mother fought to get me in there, I was allowed to go to public school.
Then nice to have that support.
Yeah. And then when I went to college and I signed up for universities, at that point I was having so much difficulty with my ankles because I had a lot of ankle issues as a teenager. And I went to Boston University. I applied there because they would take me in a wheelchair. It was one of the very few in New England schools that you could go to if you happened to be in a wheelchair. And at that point, I wasn't sure if I would be in a wheelchair or not, but I wanted to make sure I could still go to classes. So I applied to Boston University. I sent in all of the paperwork. I was accepted early. And then they wrote me a letter and said, we would like to see you in the housing office, I think it was. And so I went to Boston. I went into the office of this woman who said, well, we don't quite know where to place you because you might be in a wheelchair. And the only really accessible building we have at this point is really for the upper classes. Freshmen are not allowed in that building. But that's the only building we have. So we have to make you go there, but nobody's going to want to live with you. And at the time, I was wearing a leg brace to support the ankle, and it was big and ugly, and it was, you know, huge shoe with the metal bars up the two sides of the leg. And she's staring at my leg when she says, nobody will want to live with you. I said, that's too bad. I've been accepted. You know.
At this point, unless Peter has another question, I would like to open our.
Yeah, I want to do one more thing, if you don't mind, Bob.
Go ahead, Peter.
I would like you to talk about the place that love places is in your book, broadly defined. I'm especially if you want to talk about your partner, that would be great. But you know, love is a major theme in your book, and what love is
it
isn't. And talk a little about that.
Well, to me, it's what sustained me through all of these things, through all of the life experiences that I have had, why I spent every ounce of energy I had in taking care of my parents, but also in standing up for myself was love, and the love my parents gave me, but also the love that I gave them back. And when people ask, you know, how did you get through all of this? And as you know, there's a lot more to the story than we've had a chance to talk about. But yes, I responded, it was love.
Yeah. Let's open up for questions. I have a few more, yeah. But let's see.
So this is In Perspective. I'm Bob Branco. He's Peter Altschul. And our guest is Linda Wright, author of My Turn, The Caregiving Role Reverse. I think I've said that right, Linda. Correct me if I'm wrong. Anyway, let me ask Steve if we have any hands raised.
We have no hands right now.
If that changes, please
let us know when it changes. Yes.
I suspect we will have hands raised at some point. So if you don't mind, can you talk about Robin?
Oh, sure. What would you like to know? Robin is my spouse.
Your spouse. Yeah, I'm really intrigued about how that trajectory of that relationship went. You write about that throughout your book, and also about the wedding and all that, which I found really moving and interesting. I don't want you to give away too much, but sort of talk about Robin and the role she played in supporting you.
Well, I met Robin when we were undergraduates, and we were actually roommates at Boston University a long, long time ago, more than 50 years we've been together at this point. We've actually lived together for 51 years. And we graduated from Boston University in the same year. Then she moved to Connecticut with her parents. I moved to Springfield to live with my parents. And then she was accepted into, first she went to Yale Divinity School. And I worked for a public library for a couple of years. And then we both did postgraduate work in Boston. So we moved back to Boston and decided we would live together. And we were basically good friends for years. And it took us a while to realize that, in fact, we didn't really want to live with anybody other than each other. And, that we really cared a great deal. And that's where the love comes in. You know, we really did love each other. And that was it was challenging to admit, because so much homophobia exists. And I think it's a different thing when it's your heart leading your attitude somewhere. We clearly did not. How can I put this nicely? We did not think of ourselves as being gay or lesbian. We had to face the reality that, in fact, we didn't actually want to live with anybody else. So we changed our relationship and did eventually get married. We first did a service of Holy Union in our church. And that was before it was legal for us to marry, but our church supported holy unions. And then later when the Commonwealth of Massachusetts made it possible, we were legally married.
And you really describe that wedding in beautiful, way in the book.
Thank you.
I encourage folks to read that portion of the book. So I want to, there's a story which I wanted to ask you to share. We talked a little about the medical profession and the good and the bad.
Mm.
And there was a doctor who I think made it possible for you to go to graduate school to get your Library of Science degree.
Yes.
Tell that story because I think it's really interesting. I thought this story is fascinating.
Well, that's another school disaster in a way. I mean, I knew that when I applied to Simmons College in Boston, and they sent out a long health checklist that you had to get a doctor to certify as part of the application to get your master's degree. At that time, it was a master's degree in library science. And so I took the form to my doctor and I said, can you fill this out? And he basically said, this is not their business. And he just, you know, scratched through the thing and basically said, you know, she is perfectly capable of doing this program and allowed me to return it in that shape. And, and he got away with it. And I did not know why the form was so complex until, as I was a student at Simmons, they started to reauthorize the National Library Association gives certification to certain colleges and universities so that they can give degrees in library and science. And so they were doing that for Simmons, and they asked for student volunteers and professors to work with it. And I volunteered to work on the admission part of it because I was still curious. And son of a gun, the head of admissions at Simmons at the time said, well, you know, we do that complex form because we don't want cripples to be librarians. It's a bad image. And really? the teacher who was with me went berserk. I did not have to tell her what I thought of her. I just had to sit back and watch him ream her out. and was so glad that, you know, I had asked that question about why do you do this form and ask for all of this medical information.
That really is an extraordinary story. You know, I think all of us as disabled folks have stories like that.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's remarkable that your doctor had the foresight and the courage, yes, to essentially say, this is none of your business.
Yes.
He's capable of doing this work.
Yes.
You know, go jump.
I mean, I had already been working in a public library, right, at that point for several years. So, you know, it, there was no question, but, bad image? Who the heck? You know, I mean,
and this was when, what, this was in the '80s, nineties?
This was seventies. This was 1974, I believe.
We do have somebody who would like to speak in Clubhouse.
Okay. All right. Who would that be?
Let's take it.
Who would that be, Steve?
Brad?
Hi, Brad.
No, Brad's the, Brad,
yeah,
are you
but,
around?
Yeah, Brad's the keeper of the Clubhouse, but, he has to bring the person on stage.
Okay. They're probably muted at this moment.
Brad, are you muted?
Yeah, Brad, is that Brad? You are muted if you don't know that. Okay, well,
let's continue going. Yeah. Brad, yeah, if you can get this person unmuted, we would love to hear from him. Do you have any sense of how things have changed since then? You know, it's just, that's 50 years ago. Do you have any sense of how things have changed?
I think that we achieved a great deal of laws that allowed people to go to, say, public schools without being discriminated against. But those laws, unfortunately, have been not fully enforced, just like the ADA has not been fully enforced. Certainly what I see is most people ignoring a lot of that law or not capable of actually serving people with disabilities in the ways that I think people are entitled to.
I've heard similar stories, Linda. You're not alone in that belief.
Okay. And so, you know, we've had a lot of success in some ways, but, we still have a lot of work to do. And my personal opinion and belief is that we need to organize better. We need to stop thinking of ourselves as a small group of people who, for example, I'm in a small group of people who have a bleeding disorder. You're a lot of people in this program are people who have experienced vision loss or blindness. It's not just about what our particular issue is. We're all in the same boat together. And when we begin to organize together, we realize that we also have things in common with lots of other people who have been left out and treated as less than priorities. And we should, in many ways, start thinking about what brings us together rather than what separates us.
Yeah, we're in a very, I think, dangerous time, but I don't want to go too deeply down this path.
Right.
But it's worth thinking about. do you think Simmons would have done now, you know, 50 years, would have done the same thing now that he did 50 years ago?
When Simmons called me several years after I graduated, I don't remember what year it was, but it was probably in the 1980s, they called me and asked me if I would contribute as an alum. Would I send them money? And I said, not until you accept people of color.
Wow.
And I think if we speak up to things like that, if we really, and the the professor who was on the other end of the line, who thought I was going to give money to Simmons College, he started making excuses. Oh, well, you know, those people, well, they don't get paid well enough to be in a library. And I said, that's baloney. And I know that's baloney. And if you-
What was his motive? What was his motive for saying that, do you suppose?
I think that white supremacy is the bottom line of almost all of this. And that the country was founded with a lot of division, and a lot of people still have hidden, I don't think they're conscious, but they have hidden prejudice that makes them believe that people are not equal. And we have not written that down. That's not what we wrote in our Constitution, but it is the behavior that I have seen in my lifetime.
And we do have a raised hand.
Let's do it.
Okay.
Right. Who Paula. Is it?
Hey there. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Who's this?
I can. Who is this, please?
This is Carla Hayes.
Oh, Carla.
Hi, Carla. Welcome.
And thank you. And I'm really enjoying this, and I'm very fascinated. Can't wait to read the book when it comes out. I have two sort of unrelated questions. First of all, I was a caregiver of my mother, and did you ever have like a guilt? I know when it got to the point, because I was bathing her and, you know, doing everything for her single-handedly, and then she fell and she went into a home. She'd broken her hip, her second hip. And then when, you know, I always thought I was going to bring her home.
Yeah.
They said I couldn't. And I, you know, she was to the point I really couldn't. And she said, I want to come home. I want to come home. You should understand this because you had to go away to the school for the blind. And
yeah.
I did at the time, and I had to stay there. And I often felt a lot of guilt because I wondered if she would have lived longer had I figured out a way to bring her home. And I wonder if that was ever an issue. And then if you have time, in a nutshell, how did you go about getting the AI to read your book? That was
okay. Yes. First to the guilt. Yes, I have. I don't think it goes away. I still have points that I look back on and think, oh, I am so sorry that I could not fully care for them for the rest of their lives. That's what I told them I was going to do, but it just wasn't possible. And I can't quite let go of feeling that sense of failure. That sense of not being able to do what I had really wanted to do. And I have to somehow make peace with what I was able to do. I was able to be there at their side until each one of them died, and I was able to be a presence that they were comforted by. And there were things I was able to do, but I was not, I do still feel that sense that I failed my initial goal.
And can you talk about a little about the AI?
I used a service which I cannot fully recommend, and what I don't know for sure is whether or not they are fully accessible. But there are more and more services coming up. And I know that rather than, you know, I searched online, found a service that really worked for me. And, the person who was, it was probably a very small business. The tech support was not as good as I would have liked. But it's all very new and it's all very changing. And so I now know that there are more and more coming along. It is possible to do this? Every day there are new ones coming along.
And well, you know, AI is very, very fascinating. I won't deny that. I'm just concerned about what it's going to do to our economy down the road. That's all.
Oh, it will change our economy. There's no doubt about that. There are a couple of books I can highly recommend on the subject. It's definitely going to change. The only thing in life that's sure is change.
Yeah. So, I wanted to, another theme that's in your book, which I'd like to thank you, Carla, by the way. I appreciate it. And your comment reminded me, I want to ask you about the role that faith plays in your book. Because there are quite a few references, oblique references, but
yeah, right. I mean, I think that faith is such a personal thing, and it is so tied into language, isn't it? You know, people use different words to describe their faith, and sometimes words get in the way. So I was very aware as I was writing the book to try to use words that were more universal. And that is part of my belief. I mean, I think that my faith is definitely based on equity and compassion and diversity, and those are all rooted in my faith.
You're also married to a Christian minister, right?
I am.
And I guess my question sort of connected with that is, what's happened since your book? In other words, you know, you sort of end the book when the parents die and the two of you get married.
Yeah. I ended that book, at the point at which I had just been diagnosed with liver cancer. I didn't want to write that in the book.
Sure.
Because I didn't know what was going to happen. And I literally thought, well, if I survived the liver cancer, then I'll write another book. But what really happened was that I was taken, I got on the fast track for a liver transplant, and I received a liver transplant actually at the very point at which my book was being published. It took a good year before I was back in any shape at all. And if I had been physically capable, I would have taken notes about all of that time, about the transplant. You know, I had it in my mind, I should write about this. This is really incredible. But the liver transplant not only cured the damage that I had gotten from hepatitis C, and I got hepatitis C from all the blood products I had to use to get my blood to clot. So it not only cured me of, I cured myself through a new medication of the hepatitis C. It cured the liver damage, which included cirrhosis and eventually liver cancer, because I now have a different liver, and that liver makes the clotting factor that I did not have for the first 60 plus years of my life.
It was very successful.
It was really successful.
Absolutely, I can tell.
It was so successful that the doctors were practically jumping up and down because they were curing so many things with one surgery.
So does that mean your blood now coagulates?
Yes. And let me tell you, Brad is unmuted, so perhaps we can bring the clubhouse person on now.
Oh, perfect.
Go ahead, clubhouse person.
I couldn't please identify get a response out of him, so.
Oh, all right.
I'm not sure what happened there, but if he raises his hand, we'll try it again.
So does this a replacement sort of change the, you know, can your blood coagulate now, or how?
Yes,
how are things different?
Yeah, I can, it can, and it does, and it's like having another body altogether.
And that's a remarkable story.
And, but I never got back to writing after that. And now that I'm in a couple of writing groups, maybe someday I'll get back into writing. That is
quite a story.
Yeah.
How has that changed your life?
Radically. Yeah. I believe I've
got William back on stage. William, are you able to
hear me? Yes, I'm. Can you hear me?
Yeah, William, welcome.
Okay. Sorry, the mute function's a little, I'm getting used to it. But no, I had a question, for the author. You said you used AI in the production of your, book.
Yes.
Was that for reading in turn? Cause I know you were talking about, you know, it's expensive to get a reader to come in and read the book for audio.
Right.
So did you use AI to help you with audio?
Yes. It's an AI reader. The narrator of the book is a person who probably spoke into a recorder and they used her voice to pattern. Anybody can do this, by the way, themselves. Now you can record your voice and they will have you say different things in different emotions and then they will piece it together and read anything using that voice.
Sort of like they do with Siri.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. I mean, what limited experience I do have with AI, it does amazing stuff now. So.
Right.
That would be
the thing that most people should do is record their own voice and then read their whole book with the AI, but using their own voice.
That's really interesting. That's fascinating. So I think we are getting to the point where I need to ask how people can purchase your book or how
we have about 2 minutes. So yeah, thank you, by the way, William, for your contribution.
Thank you, William. Yeah.
All right.
You're welcome.
Okay. I have a website, of course, which is Graywood Press. That's all one word, GrayWoodPress.com. That particular website has my blog, which I'm not writing to as much as I used to, but I'm still occasionally putting things up. But it also has a page about the book and a page about me and some reviews on it and that sort of thing. And as I said, it is already available on Bookshare and will be available on Bard probably next month.
The name of the book is My Turn, When Caregiving Roles Reverse.
Yeah.
Very appropriate title, Linda, for your topic today. We really appreciate having you on the program. And you have anything else in the works?
Not at the moment. I am an excited member of Behind Our Eyes. I also belong to two other writing groups, and I'm trying to get back into the habit of writing.
Well, if you write something, another book or something else, let us know. We'll get you back on our show.
Absolutely, Linda. We're glad to have you with us, and thank you, and good luck with your book. We're all authors here on this panel right now, and we all appreciate one another, and we all understand the work that's involved. So we're very familiar with that process. Good luck, Linda, and thank you so much.
I hope you're feeling better.
I'm sorry?
I hope Peter is recovering from whatever.
I'm recovering. It'll take a couple of days, but okay. I'm okay.
You sound good.
I wasn't too loopy, so that's the important thing.
I would never have known that had you not mentioned that at the beginning of the
podcast. That's good. That's good to know. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, everyone. Go
thanks, y'all.
Blessings and have a nice week, everybody.